From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, sexual harassment among employees in Michigan prisons and why there's no transparency about the harassers.
Often they're transferred to other facilities. One attorney compared it to the Catholic Church moving problem priests.
Paying for our criminal courts in Michigan, a panel of judges wrestles with some crucial questions.
How do we fund the courts? How do we fund a justice system? Is this justice system primarily motivated by enhancing public safety? Are primarily motivated by revenue generation.
Thousands of students gather in Detroit for the World Robotics Championship. Why it's a sport where kids can go pro.
There's so much automotive industry and engineering presence in Michigan that they want to help all the high school students get a leg up and bring that talent into our companies as well.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. State lawmakers are deep in the process of taking testimony and drafting bills in response to the Larry Nassar scandal at Michigan State University. Michigan Radio's Lansing reporter Shayna Roth is with us now for an update. Shayna, how many bills are being considered right now by the Senate and the House?
So the Senate has a package of 10 bills that were in direct response to Larry Nassar. And then the House has a bill package of 18. And then there's a couple other sort of related but not within that package bills out there. And then each the House and Senate have their higher education bills, which have provisions in them that are in response to Nassar and Michigan State University.
So let's start in the Senate. What are they trying to correct or change with their bills?
So the Senate bills seem to be mostly focused on prevention and penalties. These are bills that would do things like change the statute of limitations for criminal cases, but also for civil cases. They increase penalties for failure to report suspected child abuse, but they also sort of broaden the scope of who is considered a mandatory reporter or somebody who is required by law to report suspected child abuse. And then it also hits on government immunity. They want to make sure that some individuals or entities would not be able to hide under government immunity if they, you know, should have known that there was misconduct and failed to report it.
And then in the House, they've been digging really deeply into MSU's handling of the complaints against Larry Nassar over the years, haven't they?
Yes, and their bills really seem to reflect that. The bills that came out of the package from this big investigation that they did, you know, they looked through thousands of documents that they got from Michigan State University. So their bills are focused, a lot of them, on the medical community. They want to put penalties on doctors who fail to document certain types of treatment. They want to add, you know, which types of treatment doctors now have to document or have a person in the room with them. And then they're also focused on education. There's a bill that would require sex education for 11th and 12th graders to include instruction on sexual assault and dating violence. There's a couple other bills that are kind of along that similar vein where they're trying to teach students really young, from a young age, you know, what is sexual assault? What is a bad relationship?
And what about the state's budget, Shayna? How did lawmakers respond to Nassar when they were doling out money?
Well, they are willing to hit them in their pocketbooks. Neither provision exclusively says, you know, MSU, we are taking away X amount of money. However, the Senate budget does include $14.3 million just for campus safety programs, sexual assault prevention, and student mental health. It would also include a provision that all university presidents and governing officials that receive Title IX complaints of sexual assault, they have to be told about them. And then the House bill would actually goes a little bit further, and it would cut a university's funding by 10% if the school doesn't adopt certain policies related to sexual assault.
There's a lot of bills here. Who's
yes.
concerned, and what are they saying?
There's concern that these bills were drafted too quickly in a sort of mass response to something that happened. Medical professionals are very concerned about these reporting requirements and these sort of maintaining of records. They don't think that doctors should be guilty of a crime if they accidentally don't document something or fail to document something. There was also, when the Senate bills were getting passed in the Senate, those are all waiting in the House now, there was concern with the Senate bills that they would, as far as the statute of limitations goes for these civil cases, the church and some other organizations were concerned that you would be opening the floodgates and there would be unintended consequences if suddenly you open the doors to all of these civil complaints and civil lawsuits for cases of sexual assault.
What about Nassar survivors? Are they backing these bills?
In broad strokes, they do seem to be. During a committee hearing today, Emma Ann Miller, who is a survivor of Larry Nassar, she's 15. She came in front of the committee and she essentially said that you need to pass these bills and you need to do it quickly. That, you know, they really want real change. They want, you know, to be taken seriously and they want a, you know, sort of tangible response to what happened to them. However, there were survivors that were frustrated with the Senate when it was passing its bills because they were paring back the length of time for the statute of limitations for civil complaints, and that they were sort of doing some of these amendments to the bills that would make them maybe not as tough as they were initially told that they would be.
Michigan Radio's Lansing reporter, Shanna Roth. Shanna, thank you.
Thank you.
As the legislature seeks to address sexual assault at Michigan State University, the Detroit Free Press is probing sexual harassment among employees in Michigan's prisons. The paper reports women who work for the Michigan Department of Corrections say even though the state pledged 30 years ago to end sexual harassment, it is still a problem. And so far, the department is refusing to share many details. Detroit Free Press reporter Paul Egan is with us now. Paul, you report this week that corrections employees filed 186 sexual harassment complaints between 2015 and 2017. So how many employees were actually disciplined following the complaints?
30 were, so a fairly small percentage of those.
And you filed a FOIA request with the Department of Corrections to learn what precisely?
Well, we filed a number of FOIA requests. Part of this started when we had specific reports of specific prison officials and asked for their discipline records and found that those would not be released. And since they weren't exempted under the state FOIA law, we found out that there was a special 1994 amendment to the Corrections Act that made all of these personnel records secret.
Do we know why that was passed?
We're not sure. What I'm hearing is that there was concern that prisoners, of course, prisoners are not allowed to file Freedom of Information Act requests anyway, but that there was some concern that if they found out about anything in somebody's personnel record that they could somehow use it against them. It doesn't seem like a very good argument, one, because prisoners are not allowed to file FOIA requests. Two, I mean, if you look at other law enforcement agencies like the Michigan State Police, for example, we're able to find out what state troopers are disciplined for.
You also checked around with other states. You looked at the 10 states closest to Michigan in population. And what did you find?
We found that in most of those similarly sized states, you would at least be able to find out if somebody had been found to have violated work rules related to sexual harassment, you would be able to find out who they are. And in Michigan, that's not the case. Of course, a lot of this comes out other ways, Cynthia, through lawsuits, or if you're just contacted by the victim, perhaps she can have records that she'll turn over to you. And sometimes if an employee gets disciplined and then they appeal the discipline through the civil service process, that also becomes a public record.
But this refusal to publicly disclose information, what is that saying about the department's sexual harassment problems? As you talk to experts, what did you hear?
Well, there is a general sense among many experts that when things are hidden, they are allowed to continue and to multiply. And one of the things that we have found from the records we were able to access is that supervisors that have been found to sexually harass subordinates, often if they are disciplined, they get a very short suspension. Often they're transferred to other facilities. One attorney compared it to the Catholic Church moving problem priests from one parish to another, where they are then able to harass an unsuspecting subordinate who's not aware of their past record.
In fact, your piece in today's Free Press kind of references a mostly male environment with a work culture similar to that blue wall of silence associated with police departments.
Yes, Cynthia, and that's the other part of this, is that women who do complain, we've found many cases where they are then retaliated against. There are so many work rules in the Department of Corrections, and so many of them can be subjectively applied and interpreted that, you know, basically, if a supervisor wants to write you up for something, they can.
So for women who have stepped forward and filed complaints, what are they watching over their shoulders? Is that the kind of stories you're hearing?
And sometimes literally, there are so many cameras in prisons. We actually heard of one supervisor who got in a little bit of trouble because he had been nonstop watching one female subordinate for his entire shift. And from what we understand, the reason he was watching her was to see if she possibly broke any rule that she could then be written up for.
Paul, any response to the stories you've been doing from state lawmakers, first of all?
A little bit. At least one lawmaker who's been pushing for changes, State Rep Jeremy Moss, who's been trying to liberalize our freedom of information laws. He said he's very concerned, you know, wasn't entirely aware of this amendment to the Corrections Act and that he thinks this needs a hard look. We've also heard from some others that just say that this is among a number of issues that they want to go over with the department director the next time they get a chance to talk to her.
What kind of response from the Corrections Department?
Generally, the director came out and said, you know, she really didn't deny anything in the story, but said that, you know, in general, that she does not tolerate sexual harassment and will not tolerate retaliation. On Friday, the day our first installment ran, she sent a memo to every employee in the Department of Corrections, kind of reiterating that, saying, look, the Free Press has a series going. I want you to know this is a serious matter, and we're going to take it seriously. But when you talk to many current and former employees, particularly women, they certainly don't see it that way.
As you've worked on this series of reports, Paul, what has jumped out at you the most?
I think what to me was the most interesting is how the Department of Corrections is so different from other state agencies because, you know, when you think about it, it's paramilitary. At one time, it was all men in these male prisons. There was a federal court order in 1980 that required them to start hiring women. And there was also an affirmative action order. And I think part of what happened here is you had, at that time, they were building more and more prisons. They were hiring more and more officers, and they hired many more women, and in some cases they were being promoted a little more quickly than these men. And I think there was an old guard there that just totally resented women being in the prisons at all. And some of this harassment, I think, is still related to that. And although many of those old-timers have now retired, those who are still with the department, some of them are in positions of high authority in the department now because of their seniority. And, you know, I should say that it only takes a minority of people who are harassers to make a very poisoned environment. And you know, many, I would say, you know, most of the department's employees, both regular rank and file and supervisors, are not guilty of this kind of conduct. But it doesn't take very many to make a work environment that can be quite hostile.
Paul Egan, Detroit Free Press. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
The world's largest robotics competition comes to Detroit, and one school has made it to the world's representing Detroit. That story comes up in 10 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time to check out what's on offer from professional theater companies all over Michigan. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is back with us. A lot of diversity this time around.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's great about covering theater in this area and in the state of Michigan, it's just the breadth. Every week, every time I come on, the diversity of the shows. You know, I'm moving in about 6 weeks, and I'm seriously considering killing off my cable because of the amazing theater that I'm able to see all the time.
Where are we beginning?
First up is a show opening this week. It's a musical that should be under the heading of familiar to many. It's called Big Fish, and it's at the Encore Musical Theater in Dexter. No, it's not the musical version of Jaws, in case you were thinking that, or one of those singing fish that you mount to the wall. This is a show based on a 1998 novel called Big Fish, Novel of Mythic Proportions. And it's about the relationship between Edward Bloom, who's a traveling salesman, and his adult son, Will, who tries to see what's behind his dad's tall tales, his fish stories, if you will.
I remember the 2003 film. We loved it with Ewan McGregor.
Yes. The musical diverts a bit from the movie treatment. So if you're a fan of the movie and you see the musical and you're doing some head scratching, that's why. It's adapted from the novel, and both the movie and the show kind of took their own stuff. I've seen this twice before. I'm really looking forward to this production. I talked to Encore's artistic director, Thalia Schramm, this week about why she chose it and what people can expect.
Oh, I think everyone is going to find some connection to it. I feel like everyone is kind of an Edward or a Will in their lives. So either like a big storyteller and a dreamer, or very straightforward and kind of sees the science in everything and wants to try to find the truth in everything. But it's really beautiful. I feel like everyone can really find an emotional connection to it.
That sounds good. So that's the Encore Musical Theater in Dexter with Big Fish. And now to Ann Arbor.
Yeah, staying local. It's a theater company that's been around for a few years now, but only recently went from being community to professional level. It's called Brass Tacks Theater Ensemble. And it's opening a particular favorite of mine this week, The 39 Steps. This is a very funny play. It's not only based on the Alfred Hitchcock film from the 1930s of the same name, but the play, which is run in London, New York, and it's toured, is actually an exercise in bringing the film to the stage. And it's a very unique experience. The goal of the production, in fact, it works with a few actors. There's one actor who plays Richard Hannay, who's the protagonist. Mm-hmm. And he's on the run from Scotland Yard for a murder he did not commit. The story takes you through English countryside, through Scotland moors. It's all done on stage. A couple of other actors collectively must play about 12, 14 other characters in the show. This film is a bit of a cult classic Hitchcock movie. It's been remade a few times. If you've seen the movie, it'll be like 16 times funnier than it is just on its own if you haven't seen the movie.
All right. And as you say, you've got an actor playing multiple roles. I'm a sucker for that.
It's an amazing exercise for an actor who can do that. There are two characters in this play. They change on a dime, their characters and their costumes and their hats, and it's just fascinating to watch.
And we also stay in Ann Arbor now with the Wild Swan Theater Company.
Yes. They are doing The Wizard of Oz. And Wild Swan, it's youth production. They do shows for kids all the time. They perform at the Washtenaw Community College Theater, the Townsley. All of their shows are about an hour, which is what the perfect for small kids. And I talked to Sandy Ryder, who's with the company, about this particular production and treatment of The Wizard of Oz.
Well, if you come to see our production, which we really hope you will, you'll definitely see the story written by L. Frank Baum, which is full of a lot of things that aren't in the movie that we all know so well from MGM, such as the slippers are silver. There's this great creature called a Kalida that the Tin Woodsman and the Scarecrow and the Lion and Dorothy have to figure out how to escape from. It's just really true to that story.
That does sound fun. So we're looking at what, kids about 7 and up?
Yeah, I would say for a show like this, it's about 6 to 12. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I'm very interested to see it too, because it does not cling to the movie treatment. It really goes back to the original story.
Very good. And now to Detroit, Wayne State University's theater program, which is an excellent program, and they're bringing us The Bard.
Yes, King Lear. It's a family drama about political conquest. Does this sound familiar to you at all? It opens April 27th at the Hillbury Theater, which is an excellent space if people who have not been there before. It's on Cass in Midtown Detroit, just a couple of blocks off Woodward. I like to think that everyone knows the plot, but I'll assume nothing. Ready to split his kingdom among his three daughters, Lear arranges a contest of adoration, asking each to express their love and devotion to him. And I like the look of this cast quite a lot, so I'm eager to see it myself.
Very, very good. And then we're winding up in Rochester Hills, also on a campus at Oakland University at the Meadowbrook Theater.
Right. They're doing a review called All Night Strut. This is a throwback show to the 30s and 40s featuring singing and dancing. Like I said, it's a review, and it features the music of the Great Depression through World War II. So we're talking about songs like Chattanooga Choo Choo, As Time Goes By, Ain't Misbehavin', and so on. You know, I just want to mention, we're in the 75th anniversary of World War II, so a lot of theatergoers are gravitating to shows that kind of let us remember that time. I think when the country was much more united, it was, yes, a time of great struggle. The world was suffering, but the music, Cynthia, yes. endure so much. I mean, I know you and I love
yes,
it.
But
I just, you know, I want to take a moment because the show reminds me of something that's very important to me. My son's in high school. He's a sophomore. And every year it seems we're seeing our public education marginalize the arts, music, art history, theater. And this show reminds me, if we're not studying the history of music and art and theater, then we're not studying history. The artistic expressions that come out of this period are as important, if not more so, than learning about the causes and the outcomes of wars, of the Depression. I know a show like this is likely to attract more grandparents than their grandchildren, but I'd love to see grandkids going with their grandparents to see this show and take in the music and talk about it afterwards.
That sounds terrific. Well, we got a big array of options for us, as you say, very diverse, David. And you can get all the details of these and other productions very easily. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, many thanks.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. The robots are coming. Hundreds of them, in fact. The world's biggest robotics competition is happening in Detroit this Wednesday through Saturday. It'll bring some 40,000 students, mentors, coaches, and their families to Ford Field and Cobo Center. And, of course, the robots. It's the first year that the World Robotics Championship is being held in Michigan. And that's fitting. Michigan has 508 high school robotics teams this year, more than any other state, and way ahead of second place California with 314 teams. Now, one of the teams coming to compete at the World Robotics Championship is the Cesar Chavez Academy, the Aztec Eagles. Milton Martinez is the chief engineer for this team and a global diagnostic strategist for General Motors. Milton, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome Kaylin Hicks. She's a senior at Detroit's Cesar Chavez Academy, and she's been with the Aztec Eagles since she was a freshman, and she is the team captain. Kaylin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We have to start out right away by congratulating the Aztecs going through district competitions and the state championship and becoming the only Detroit team to get to the world competition. So you are representing Detroit. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What happens at the championship? People that have never seen a robotics competition, what's going to be happening this week?
So there's four actual competitions going on simultaneously. There's the elementary students, their middle school students, and high school students. Each have their own league for robotics competition. And all of the competitions are scattered throughout the year, but they converge at the World Championships. So we're going to have competitions of all the levels. In the high school competition, which our team is, we're going to have three-on-three robot competitions, and it's a battle for the scale. This year, the competition is delivering milk crates to a teeter-totter scale, and that scale is whoever controls or has possession of the scale for the longest amount of time gets the most points and wins. And so you're seeing battles battle each other, not physically, not attacking each other, but going towards their goal and see who could score more at the shortest amount of time.
So you are given, the team is given, everybody's given a task, make whatever it is, fill in the blank, make this. So it's up to your team to tackle that engineering challenge?
Yes, actually, we often break into groups at the beginning of the season, and then we kind of decide as a team what we're going to follow or how we're going to design the robot, and then we take it from there with the rest of the 6 weeks we have.
So Milton, as the world competitions go on, do teams form alliances and work together?
Yes, the alliances are three versus three robots, and we all have four different tasks that we're trying to accomplish, and the alliances that do that the most efficiently are the winning alliances.
So my robot may have an edge on yours in one area and yours on mine, so let's work together. And
absolutely, yes, yes.
Well, certainly, as you know from your work at General Motors, it's great to have smart ideas, but you also need teamwork.
Yes, teamwork is essential to this.
Kaylin, tell us about your entry in this year's competition. What's its name?
Our robot is Edwino. And we actually have that, if you know, the Arduino. And one of our, like, our MVP last year and driver of our team was named Edwin. So we just kind of combined the names together, and it sounded pretty cool, and everyone liked
sounded
it.
Sounded pretty. Milton, what do you think it is about this team? About, you know, here we've got the team captain here with Kaylin, but what is it about the Aztecs that helped it to become the team to represent Detroit at this competition, the world competition?
So this team gets along really well. It's the long nights. It's very tiring, but they're always laughing. They're always having such a good time with each other. And it was that cohesion of the team that all those hard challenges, you know, just become easy and enjoyable. And so we are enjoying some level of success that we've never had before.
And I know you work with the Aztec Eagles as chief engineer, which means doing what?
So I'm just the main mentor. I'm the engineer. We pick chief engineers because at the Robotics Engineering Center, where we work with other teams, it's mostly GM mentors. And we decided to give ourselves these titles because that's the title of the job that we want at GM eventually. So we said, let's call ourselves chiefs engineers, and one day maybe that will happen.
And you are the chief of chiefs at that Robotics Engineering Center as well. And you went through this program. You're an alum, right?
Yes. Yes, actually 20 years ago. It's been exactly 20 years that I was a sophomore in high school. We started the robotics team. I was in El Paso, Texas. It was Team 170. And we, that year, we also made it to nationals. Back then, it was nationals. And it's 20 years. I was so excited when they were coming here. It was the anniversary of me being at nationals. And we really strived to make it to Worlds. And we did.
And you did. The championships are sponsored by FIRST, for inspiration and recognition of science and technology. Kaylin, what do those words science and technology mean to you?
I'd say science and technology mean everything to me. Like, it's basically been most of my whole life for high school. Like, from, like, what I've learned in robotics, stuff I haven't even learned in the classroom, like, just things that we've done and processes that we've ran through in robotics or stuff that didn't make sense to me in class, especially with the physics I was like, oh, now that makes sense in here. And the technology and everything, it's just been a really big part of my high school career overall.
Now, were you interested? Did you feel drawn to science and technology before you came to Cesar Chavez and you became a ninth grader and you said, I'm going to join the robotics team?
I'd say yes and no. Like, I had a vague knowledge of what any of that stuff was. But then I was actually just walking past a room one day and I just heard, okay, this is where robotics is going to be. And then right after I checked it out and saw everything, I actually started working with the electrical components on the robot. And that's when I just got hooked. And I was like, this is pretty cool.
What hooked you?
Actually, like, manipulating the wires and just seeing how everything worked and actually getting to be hands-on with it. It just seemed cool because I thought electricity and stuff like that was, you know, pretty cool. So I was like, I actually really like this. And before high school, I had a small interest. Robotics confirmed that I was interested in engineering.
And so what's going to happen this fall?
This fall, I'll be a freshman double majoring in robotics and electrical engineering at Worcester Polytechnic Institute.
So you're heading off to Massachusetts.
Yes.
I see you beaming with pride, Milton.
I am. I am so proud of Kaylin. When she joined her freshman year and wanted to be in the electrical team, she took over it. It wasn't a matter of, like, she's interested. I need to push her to do something. She was like, no, this is my area. I'm owning it. And I've been so proud of her ever since.
You know, a Michigan team has been part of the winning alliance in 9 of the past 15 world competitions, if I got my statistics right. Why do you think Michigan has such a strong presence in robotics championships?
It started close to here. Some of the original Hall of Fame teams are from here in Michigan. There's so much automotive industry and engineering presence in Michigan that they want to help all the high school students get a leg up and bring that talent into our companies as well. So we're building a local pipeline of talent for our companies. It's so helpful for us. There's so many alumni at General Motors, at all the companies around here. You recognize them. Like, I don't know who they are. I don't know their names, but I see them at competition week in, week out.
Well, you think about it. It's these robotics competitions, very much like sports, where a lot more kids have a chance to go pro.
Yeah, that's actually one of the models, is the sport where everybody can go pro.
Well, so it's going to be an exciting week. I know Ford Field, Cobo Center, and then what does the winner get?
I believe it's the banners. And then your medals, of course. And then I think there are other separate awards. Like, I know they have the Engineering Inspiration, Chairman's, Woody Flowers. Like, they have other awards aside from winning. And, of course, they have the finalists. And then specific things to your field, like your robot's creativity, your team spirit, I believe, stuff like that.
Tell us your robot's name again.
Edwino.
Well, we wish Edwino and the Aztecs of Cesar Chavez Academy all the best as you head into the World Robotics Championships in Detroit. We've been talking with Chief Engineer Milton Martinez and Kaylin Hicks, who is the team captain of the Aztec Eagles. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you
for having us.
A special invitation to you. I hope you'll join me when Stateside goes on the road for a live show from Grand Rapids. We'll be at Celebration Cinema North on Thursday evening, May the 3rd, and we would love to have you there in the audience. You can register to attend and find out all the details by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Coming up, who should foot the bill for our criminal courts? A commission has been tasked to come up with a different way for Michigan.
How do we fund the courts? How do we fund a justice system? Is this justice system primarily motivated by enhancing public safety or primarily motivated by revenue generation? These are the questions the Trial Court Funding Commission is asking, and that's why Ferguson, Missouri is a perfect example to look at.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Put 30 strangers on a bus and then set the countdown clock. 72 hours riding from Detroit to New Orleans. 72 hours for these strangers to conceive, build, and launch a startup. That's what happens starting this Friday on Startup Bus. Jay Alchi is conductor of the Startup Bus out of Detroit. He was a rider last year. Jay, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So how does this work? Riders show up with an idea or what?
So it's kind of a process because you have to actually know the riders beforehand. So they actually first, their experience begins with applying. And we discover who they are, what they do, and getting them on. When they get on the bus, they spend the first hour pitching ideas. And then they kind of organically form teams.
Interesting. So everybody kind of brings an idea that they've been kind of hatching in their mind. They don't know who's going to be on the bus with them. So there's that ice-breaking process once you're on the bus. And so what happens is the bus drives to New Orleans.
Well, lots of things happen. Basically, we're stopping at various pitch events. We're trying to get them product validation. They're building their ideas on the fly. So there are three parts to it. There's the entrepreneurship boot camp part to it, which is how do we teach people how to build businesses and how to kind of believe in their own ideas enough to pursue actually getting people to use those ideas. Right. Mm-hmm. Then there's the actual hackathon portion of it, which we're not really a hackathon, but you have to build something and you have to get the product in the hands of, you know, the people who you're trying to serve. And then there's the whole bus drive portion of it, because you are on a bus and that does things to you. By nature.
And I want to hear about that because I know you were a rider last year. So what is the atmosphere like on the bus?
So it's very grassrooty. It's very disruptive. It's intense, to say the least, but it's like the best kind of intensity because, especially at the beginning, you're kind of, you've come up with this idea, you've pitched it, and you've got to find other people to believe in the idea with you. And so it's very grassrooty. You're just trying to get support at that beginning, and then it's pushing it through all the way to, you know, having a product.
And the destination is New Orleans, and there are buses coming from all over the country, are there not?
Yes.
So Detroit's bus is one. There'll be many others. What happens when y'all get to New Orleans?
So there's a huge pitch event where there'll be potential investors, there's media, there's all sorts of things going on, and we pitch and we see who kind of comes up at the top of that totem pole.
How'd you do last year?
It's kind of funny because we had an idea that got a ton of validation and the competition was tough. So we got knocked out first round.
But is that idea something that you could see working on?
Yeah. So that's something where we did actually end up working on the idea for additional 3 or 4 months. And then over time, it's just something where we realized that we were getting A, pushed out of the market a little bit, and B, time was becoming a bigger and bigger issue.
But clearly you felt that experience was worth it because you're back this year as conductor.
Absolutely. So One of the interesting things, so, you know, you lose the first round, right? Mm-hmm. And what you discover is you don't need anyone to validate your idea from like some judging totem pole. All you need is this kind of idea that you believe in it and you're going to pursue it. And that's how entrepreneurship works. And I think that's how we kind of drive the message that the talent here in Michigan is no different than the talent in like Silicon Valley. You know, it really comes down to believing in your ideas and learning how to execute them.
So what will your job as conductor be?
So there are multiple jobs. We jokingly say cat herder at times because we have all these people. They're going to various places and we need to make sure they're safe and happy. But I've done all the logistics. I've planned all the pitch events. I've done all of the routing. I've done all the budgeting. I've done a number of things to make it happen.
Now, it is not inexpensive to hire a bus, especially one to go from Detroit to New Orleans and then get back again. So somebody had to foot the bill. How do you get the money to do this?
So that's also a very grassroots effort. There is a ticket price to ride, but I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Park Restaurant. And they're located in Campus Marshes, Detroit, and they helped out a ton. This year, they are Detroit Hours 2018 Restaurant of the Year. And I mean, they're supporting local entrepreneurship, so.
What do you hope to see for the future of Startup Bus?
So the biggest thing I hope to see for the future of Startup Bus this year, if anything, is kind of like a pilot. Can Detroit bring a bus with talent to the table? And the answer is yes, we can. Next year, the goal is to see what we can do in the grander scheme of maybe bringing all of the buses to Detroit. Because as cool as it is to go to New Orleans, Detroit and Michigan, I think, is one of the best entrepreneurship states to be in. So it's a big vision. It's a big dream. Having a bus was a big vision and big dream, and we've done it. So hopefully next year we can do that.
Because there's like a national umbrella group, and so it's part of convincing them that Detroit would be the place to come.
Absolutely, yes.
What do you know about the people who are going to be on the bus?
What do I – about my bus in particular?
Yeah.
So I know everything. I've interviewed all of them.
Okay.
We have a really cool range of developers. We have quite a few influencers. I mean, we have people where – I don't want to name exact brands.
No. Yeah, yeah.
But for example, if you think of like wearable electronics for fitness, you know, one of the first engineers to work for like one of the largest brands doing that, these are the kinds of folks we have.
So, and age range?
Age range anywhere from about 20 to 33, 34.
Well, it sounds rather interesting. It'll be like a petri dish
as
you're rolling along on those four wheels.
Absolutely. It's a lot of fun.
Jay Alchi is conductor of the 2018 Detroit Startup Bus. Best of luck getting to New Orleans and getting that idea sold.
Thank you.
What is the most appropriate way to pay for our criminal courts in Michigan? That's the essential question before the Michigan Trial Court Funding Commission. How much of the cost of administering justice should be paid for by the people who use the courts, such as those who are ticketed or arrested? And how much of the financial burden should fall to all of us, no matter if we'll never see the inside of a courtroom ourselves? At its meeting later this week, this commission will review just what happened in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014 as an example of the potential negative consequences of a profit-motivated justice system, a system that is not much different than our own in Michigan. With us now is Tom Boyd. He's chair of the Michigan Trial Court Funding Commission and a judge with the 55th District Court in Ingham County. Judge Boyd, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So this commission was created in response to a 2014 Michigan Supreme Court case, People versus Cunningham. Remind us again, what did the court rule in that case?
In June of 2014, the Supreme Court of Michigan ruled in People versus Cunningham that there's no law that allows a court to charge a criminal defendant for the cost of the day-to-day operation of the court. Now, the reason that's significant is it's what the courts have been doing for as long as anybody can remember. Now, as I've noted on the show before, in 1962, the last time Michigan had a constitutional convention, that convention specifically tried to keep money out of influencing decisions in court, and they changed the way that the municipal courts work and created the district courts. But what Cunningham said in 2014 is there's still not authority to fund the courts this way. It's been allowed to develop by habit, without any legal authority. I know it sounds strange that the way we operate courts is without legal authority, but that's really the corrupting nature of money in the system.
And so what happened as a result of that ruling?
Well, you know, as soon as the court said that you can't fund as soon as the Supreme Court said you can't fund trial courts through court costs, the people who fund trial courts, like county commissioners and city councils, I mean, I don't know any way other way to put it. They freaked out. You know, in my work, I see people who have addictions to substances, and they look a certain way. And honestly, the county's lobbyists looked a lot that way. When you look in the legislature, they really need this money. And so the court said to the legislature, this is a simple legislative fix. You should just give the trial courts the authority to fund themselves through their work. And the legislature set out doing that. Now, the District Court Judges Association, of which I'm a member, and some other organizations stood in the way and said, now, wait a minute, let's think about this. Is this the right thing to do? And in the end, what we negotiated was that there would be a period of time where the counties and cities would be allowed to continue to fund courts by charging costs to defendants, but that would be limited. And during that limited period of time, we would have a review. We would think about it thoughtfully. And the Trial Court Funding Commission is an indirect result of that process.
So how widely do fines and fees vary from court to court and county to county in Michigan? Could you give us any examples?
Yeah, you know, take, for instance, impeding traffic. Impeding traffic literally means that you're in the way. You know, that your car is in the way of other cars. You're impeding the normal flow of traffic. And the State Court Administrative Office, which is the constitutionally created state administrative arm of the Michigan Supreme Court, they say that it should cost between $93 and $111 to process that type of a case. So if we wanted to recoup the money for an impeding traffic, our fine and cost and everything would be about somewhere in that range, $93 to $111. Now, in reality, I've done studies of these cases in mid-Michigan and in Kent County, and nobody's within that range. And sometimes these tickets are as high as $225. So it really depends on what it is that the local community is trying to do with their court. And a lot of the time, especially at the district or municipal court level, what they're trying to do is to pay for all of the court operations. They're trying to generate revenue neutral or maybe even make a profit.
So is there a standard formula or no?
The state court administrative number is a guideline. It's not a mandate.
Okay.
The law in this area, and I think one of the big things the Trial Court Funding Commission is looking at is what is today and what ought to be in the future. And specifically, the legislation creating the commission asks us to review and recommend changes in the trial court funding system and to review and recommend changes in the methods by which courts impose and allocate fees and costs. So these are the kind of things that we're doing.
Judge Budd, what have been the consequences, the real on-the-ground consequences of this inconsistent, somewhat arbitrary system for Michigan residents?
Well, let me put that into two categories. First of all, the people caught up in the system lose their driving privileges, end up getting in more trouble by driving to work without a license. Now they have a criminal charge, driving while license suspended, and it just becomes a snowball effect. And we've talked a lot about the driver's responsibility fee on the program, and you know, luckily the legislature's seen the wisdom of finally phasing that out, and so we can try and get people their driving privileges back. But by some accounts, as many as 25% of the people in the state are driving without a license, and that is a indirect consequence of the profit-motivated justice system that we've allowed to be created. You know, which really brings us to the second point, which is there's a general disaffection from government. Now, this is not news.
No.
Everybody who listens to your program or pays attention to the news knows that we're at a situation where the general public feels disaffected from government, that government isn't of the people, by the people, that we're not really trying to work together to solve common problems, that it's us versus them and on and on. So just earlier this month, on the 4th of April, the Court of Appeals of Michigan decided a case named People versus Cameron. And in that case, the Court of Appeals declared the ability to assess this cost, which is what we got from the legislature in 2014, as disproportionate. Because what they said was that the court system confers benefit to the general public, justice, fairness, order, not the particular person on whom the cost is imposed. So the question becomes, who does the court benefit? And the way I look at it is the drunk driver really the only person that benefits from his or her arrest? Mm. It just seems to me to be a no-brainer that we all benefit from the drunk driver being taken off the road and his or her rehabilitation so that they don't do that again. I know as a parent of now young adults, but they used to be young drivers, that I don't want them to meet a drunk driver in the middle of the night. And by law enforcement, arresting drunk drivers in courts, handling those cases in a way that stops recidivism, it protects myself and my young drivers. It's not something that only benefits the person who's standing before the court. So that disproportionate penalty or that disproportionate tax on the defendant is really what was going on in Ferguson, Missouri.
Let's talk about that. Why did you decide that what happened in 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri needed to be part of the commission's review?
The fines and costs system in Missouri is very similar to that we use in Michigan, in that the local community tasks its courts, its judges, to raise money to fund themselves. You know, in opposing the bill in 2014 to allow the courts to assess costs to defendants, I said to the legislative committee, I said, now, if your daughter were at Michigan State and she wandered across Hagedorn Road into my jurisdiction and she got an MIP ticket and she came home and said, Mom, Dad, I didn't do it. I wasn't drinking and I didn't have any alcohol in my possession. Do you really want in the back of my mind to be thinking, you know, if she's not guilty, I don't get $300? It isn't the way that the process should work. We should be detached. And as it is now, district court judges like myself, we're responsible for bringing in enough revenue to make the operation run. So if our court doesn't collect enough money, maybe they're going to lay somebody off. Maybe it makes me harder to do my job. Maybe it makes it more likely that I'm going to get an opponent in the next election. These are all incredibly inappropriate considerations that no judge should have to have in their mind. It's one of the things the Constitution in 1962-63 intended to fix. Hmm. But here we are, 2018, and we're still worried about it. In Ferguson, Missouri, we all know that young Michael Brown was killed. And what we saw then was an explosion of sentiment, an explosion of feeling, unrest in the streets.
That went for days.
And when the Department of Justice went in afterwards and reviewed what happened, they said the death of the young man was only the match that hit a gasoline-soaked bale of hay. And the gasoline-soaked bale of hay was the policing system and the court system. The court system just generated revenue to run the city, and they did it through fines and fees and allocations with the police. So the court, in partnership with the police, had created this major disaffection with the community. So we're back to disaffection. How do we fund the courts? How do we fund a justice system? Is this justice system primarily motivated by enhancing public safety or primarily motivated by revenue generation? These are the questions the Trial Court Funding Commission is asking, and that's why Ferguson, Missouri is a perfect example to look at.
Judge Boyd, fundamentally, what is problematic with requiring people who break the law and end up in a Michigan courtroom to pay a so-called user fee, if you will, or bear some of the burden of funding the administration of their own justice? That seems to make sense, no?
No, that makes perfect sense. As a matter of fact, I assess fines and costs every day. Since 1835, the Michigan Constitution has said all penal fines go to the library. Why did they do that? And every constitution since. They did that so that the money assessed from a defendant doesn't corrupt the justice system. So it's not about whether or not the defendant should pay. They should, and they do. The question is whether or not the judge should have to meet a budget the same way the butcher or the baker does. That's the corrupting link. Absolutely. People who commit crime in our society, a financial penalty is really the biggest thing that we use these days. So it is not about whether they should pay. They should. The question is about how we fund our courts, not the penalty to the defendant.
The commission must file its final report by the end of September of 2019?
Yes, ma'am.
Then what?
Well, you know, honestly, what we've been focused on as a commission, we were created right before Thanksgiving. We met for the first time in December as the statute required. Our motivating principle has been, it's actually a quote from Albert Einstein, and that is, if I had 20 days to solve a problem, I would spend 19 days defining that problem. So we're still very much in the process of defining that problem. Eventually, we'll make recommendations, because that's what the statute asks us to do. But honestly, I couldn't say today what those recommendations might be, because we're still very involved in defining the problem and looking at worst-case scenarios like Ferguson, Missouri is a part of defining the problem in Michigan.
Judge Tom Boyd is chair of the Michigan Trial Court Funding Commission, as well as chief judge of the 55th District Court in Ingham County. Judge Boyd, thank you so much for your time.
It was my pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.